The Great Second Advent Movement by J.N. Loughborough, Chapter 21. The Guiding Hand in the Work. I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. Psalm 32, verse 8. To him who makes the Lord his trust, his care is continually manifest. There are times, however, when this care is more especially realized, such as special deliverances from evils and dangers seen and unseen, and direct providential openings for the extension of his truth. It is of these themes that this chapter treats. The First Vision in Michigan. In the month of May, 1853, Elder White and his wife visited Michigan. It was the first time they had been west of Buffalo, New York. The last Sabbath in May, they were at Tyrone, and at that place, Mrs. White was shown in vision the different companies of Sabbath keepers in the state, with warnings as to the influences that were liable to work against them. On June 2nd, in Jackson, she wrote 8 pages of foolscap, stating some of the things which had been shown her. She gave me a pencil copy of the vision on condition that I would furnish her a plain copy written with pen and ink. A woman who professed holiness. Among other things shown, there was described the case of a woman who was trying to intrude herself among our people. She said this woman professed great holiness. Mrs. White had never met her, and had no knowledge of her except that which was imparted to her in this vision. She not only told the woman's mode of procedure, but also that when she should be reproved, she would put on a sanctimonious look and say, "The Lord knows my heart." She said this woman was traveling about the country with a young man, while her husband, an old man, was at home working to support them in their evil course. Mrs. White said that the Lord had shown her that, notwithstanding the woman's pretensions to holiness, she and the young man were guilty of violating the 7th commandment. With the written description of this case in my pocket, I waited with some anxiety to see how matters would turn. The meeting in Virginies, Michigan. We had meetings in Jackson, Battle Creek, Bedford, and Hastings, and then came to Virginies, Kent Company, which proved to be the place where the woman lived. We arrived at the place where we were to tarry for the night on June 11, a little before the Sabbath. Our stopping place was the home of an Elder White who had been formerly a minister of the Christian denomination. As this was a newly settled country, preparations had been made for our meetings in a large, newly built barn 3 miles farther on, and the woman seen in vision, as it proved, lived still 2 miles beyond the place of meeting. Testimony to the Fanatic. June 12, at 10:30 a.m., we assembled in the barn for meeting. Mrs. White sat at the left end of the rostrum. I sat next to her. Elder Cornell next to me, and Elder White was at the right of the rostrum speaking. After he had been talking about 15 minutes, an old man and a young man came in together and sat down on the front seat next to the rostrum. They were accompanied by a tall, slim, dark-complexioned woman who took her seat near the door. After a short discourse by Elder White, Mrs. White arose and introduced her remarks by speaking of the care ministers should have that they mar not the work committed to them, using the text, "Be ye clean that bear the vessels of the Lord." She said it was not God's order to call a woman to travel about the country with any other man than her husband. Finally, she plainly said, quote, "That woman who sat down a short time since near the door claims that God has called her to preach. She is traveling with this young man who just sat down in front of the desk, while this old man, her husband, God pity him, is toiling at home to earn means which they are using to carry on their iniquity. She professes to be very holy, to be sanctified, but with all her pretense to holiness, God has shown me that she and this young man are guilty of violating the seventh commandment. Close quote. All present knew that Mrs. White had never seen these individuals until they came into the barn. Picking them out and delineating their character in the manner she did had its influence upon the minds of those present and increased their confidence and confirmed their faith in the visions. The words uttered as predicted. As Mrs. White bore her testimony, there was an anxious looking toward Mrs. Elcott, the woman reproved, to see how she received what was said and what she was going to do and say. Had she been innocent of the charge made against her, it would naturally be expected of her to rise up and deny the whole thing. If guilty and grossly corrupt, she might be none too good to deny it all, even though she knew it to be true. Instead of this, she did just what the testimony said she would do when reproved. She slowly rose to her feet, while every eye was fixed upon her, and putting on a sanctimonious look, slowly said, "The Lord knows my heart," and sat down without uttering another word. She had said just what the testimony said she would say, and said it in the same manner. Guilt acknowledged. True, God knew their hearts, and they knew themselves to be guilty of the charge. For afterward, the young man said to Mr. Gardner, a resident of the same place, who closely questioned him concerning the matter, quote, "Mr. Gardner, what Mrs. White said about us was too true," close quote. And the woman, after telling Mrs. Wilson at Greenville in 1862 that she, quote, "would not dare to say a word against Sister White lest she should be found fighting against God," close quote, admitted that what was shown about her and the young man was true. The Messenger Party. During the fall of 1853, a few disaffected ones in Michigan joined together and began the publication of a sheet called The Messenger of Truth. The mission of this sheet and its conductors seemed to be to tear down and defame instead of to build up. Many falsehoods were inserted in its pages, which annoyed us in our work in the message, and as it was our first experience with such an open attack, we thought it our duty to refute their slanderous statements. Doing this occupied time that should have been spent in advancing the truth committed to our trust, and suited well the purposes of Satan, who was undoubtedly the instigator of this opposition. And thus, the state of affairs continued until the evening of June 20, 1855, when Elder White and his wife, Elder Cottrell, and myself had just closed a meeting in Oswego, New York. We had been annoyed in our meeting by Lillis, who came in and circulated those slanderous documents among the people. Again, the question as to our duty in this matter came up. All previous efforts at answering their falsehoods had only resulted in their manufacturing more. Advice and prediction. At a prayer meeting held that evening at the house of John Place, in the city of Oswego, Mrs. White was given a vision in which she was shown that if we would keep at our work preaching the truth, regardless of any such people as the Messenger Party, they would go to war among themselves and their paper would go down, and when that should happen, we would find that our ranks had doubled. Believing this testimony to be from the Lord, we began at once to act in harmony with it. Collapse of the messenger party and paper. The cause of truth advanced rapidly while the messenger party got into trouble among themselves. In a brief space of time, the party were scattered, many of their leaders having given up the Sabbath. Their paper soon ceased for lack of support, and he who had acted for a time as editor turned his attention to teaching school, but not having learned first to govern himself, he failed utterly in governing his pupils. In attempting to correct one of the lads in his school, he drew a revolver which snapped but failed to fire. To escape lynching, he was obliged to flee in the night to Canada. Effect on the Advent cause. At this time, there existed a greater state of harmony and unity among our people than ever before. And as efforts were made to push out with the message, the way opened in every direction. In number 10, volume 11 of the review, January 14, 1858, the editor, in speaking of the result of the messenger work, said, quote, "At the time of the disaffection, when the effort was made to break down the review, the church property at the office was valued at only $700. Since then, it has increased to $5,000. Then there were about 1,000 paying subscribers. Now there are 2,000, besides quite a free list." Close quote. As we had now reached the time, 1858, when the messenger party split and scattered, and the messenger ceased to exist, the above figures are significant. As the number of paying subscribers to the review had exactly doubled, so the number of believers had more than doubled. Thus, the prediction made through Mrs. White in June of 1855 was fulfilled. Tent meetings first suggested. It was our custom in the early days of the message to hold meetings in schoolhouses when no better place was attainable. In a building of this kind, on one occasion, such a crowd of people came together that two schoolhouses of that size could not have held them. To be heard by all, the speaker stood in an open window and spoke to those in the house, to a larger audience seated in their carriages and on the grass. It was the sight of this large assembly that led to the consideration of holding tent meetings. First tent meeting in Battle Creek, Michigan. Therefore, on May 22, 1854, it was decided by Elder James White and others in council that it would be a feasible plan to use tents for meetings. At that time, large tents were very rarely used for other purposes than circuses, menageries, and shows of various kinds. Michigan was the first state in which Seventh-day Adventists made the venture in that line of working. The first tent meeting opened in Battle Creek, June 10, 1854. At the present time, this mode of holding meetings in the summer season has grown to great proportions. Camp meetings suggested. In the year 1868, another aggressive step was taken. The propriety of holding camp meetings was duly considered, and the decision was reached that this would be an excellent way to accommodate the large gatherings of our people at general meetings. Having a large tent for public services and smaller family tents, the people would be made comfortable, and thus a number of days could be spent profitably in council and worship. The first camp meeting at Wright, Michigan. The first camp meeting was held in Wright, Michigan, September 1 through 7 in 1868. These important general gatherings for our people have grown to that extent that over 50 camp meetings are held each year in various parts of the field. Not in America only are these camp meetings held, but in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. The largest assembly of this character ever held by our people was in the year 1893 at Lansing, Michigan. In that large gathering, there were 3,400 living in over 500 family tents. Over 150,000 yards of canvas were represented in the construction of the various tents in the camp. Deliverance from a railway disaster. The day after the decision was made to purchase our first 60-foot tent in May of 1854, Elder White and his wife, being then in Jackson, Michigan, were to start on their journey for Wisconsin, where they were to labor for a time. We spent the afternoon at the house of D.R. Palmer, only a short distance from the station. Several times in the afternoon, Elder White spoke, saying, quote, "I feel strangely in regard to starting on this trip, but, Ellen, we have an appointment out, and we must go. If I had not an appointment, I should not go tonight," close quote. As night came on, near the time of the arrival of the train, we had a season of prayer. All seemed led out to pray for the safety of Elder White and his wife on this journey. As we arose, Elder White expressed his faith that the Lord would have a care for them and keep them. At 8 o'clock, I went with them to the train to assist in securing seats and adjusting their parcels. We went into one car with high back seats, called in those days a sleeping car. Mrs. White said, quote, "James, I can't stay in this car. I must get out of here," close quote. I helped them in getting a seat in the middle of the next car. Mrs. White sat down with her parcels in her lap, but said, quote, "I don't feel at home on this train," close quote. The bell rang, and bidding them a hasty goodbye, I soon left for Serenia Smith's to tarry for the night. About 10 o'clock, we were all much surprised to hear Elder White, whom we supposed was well on his way to Chicago, knocking for admittance. He said the train had run off the track 3 miles west of Jackson, that most of the train, with the engine, was a total wreck, but while a number had been killed, he and Mrs. White had escaped uninjured. He soon secured a horse and a carriage, and in company with Abram Dodge, went for Mrs. White, whom the elder had carried some distance in his arms, over a wet, marshy tract of land, and across a small stream of water, to a place of safety, away from the scene of disaster. Early the next morning, I went with Mr. Dodge to view the wreck. At a point where the road crosses the track obliquely, an ox had lain down to rest directly on the track. The engine had no cow catcher, and so on striking the animal, it was thrown from the track to the left. At the first shock of the engine striking the ground, the baggage car containing Elder White's trunk of books jumped entirely clear from the track and was uninjured. At the same time, the passenger car in the rear of the train was uncoupled from the rest of the train without human aid and quietly stopped upon the track. The engine and tender ran on the ground off the track some 6 or 8 rods when the engine struck an oak stump some 3 feet in diameter. The force of the train was such that the engine was turned over bottom side up, and the back of the tender swung round across the track. The main body of the train, going with full force, struck this wreck of the engine, thus producing a second shock. The first car that struck the engine was an express car, which was crushed into kindling wood. It, with its contents, was a mass of rubbish piled upon and around the tender. The next was a second-class car containing 18 passengers, of whom one was killed, and all the rest were more or less injured. This car was split in two by the sleeping car running through it. The forepart of the sleeper was broken pieces, and the seat in which Mrs. White did not feel free to stay was completely crushed. Evidence of divine deliverance. As we viewed the wreck, and then the car in which Elder White and his wife were riding at the time of the accident, standing quietly by itself some 15 rods away from the wreck, we felt to say in our hearts that God heard prayer, and who knows but he sent his angel to uncouple that car that his servants might escape unharmed. More especially did this thought impress our minds when the brakeman said that he did not uncouple it, and furthermore, that no one was on the platform when it occurred, and that it was a mystery to himself and to all the trainmen how it was done. And what was still more mysterious to them, the link and bolt were both unbroken, and the bolt with its chain was lying on the platform of the wrecked car as though placed there by a careful hand. By the evening of the 24th, the track was so far clear of the rubbish that the trains ran as usual, and Elder and Mrs. White again entered the cars and made a safe passage to their appointment in Wisconsin. Opponents reproved. It was not all smooth sailing with ancient Israel. They had foes without who were seeking to impede their progress at every step. The mixed multitude and unconsecrated ones within the camp were ready tools through whom Satan sought to stir up discontent, strife, murmuring, and rebellion. The fact that God's prospering hand was with the confiding ones, and that victory attended their efforts, was proof that this people had found grace in his sight, that the hand of the Lord was leading them. So in the rise and progress of the third angel's message, its advancement has not been because the truths presented have been something congenial to the natural heart of man. On the contrary, the very central truth of the message, the Sabbath of the Lord, conflicts with selfish, worldly interests, separating those who obey it from the business of the world 2 days in a week. The cause of present truth has had its external foes determined and persistent in their efforts to overthrow the work. Of them, it may be said in the words of the psalmist, "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, now may Israel say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, when men rose up against us, then they had swallowed us up quick when their wrath was kindled against us." Psalms 124, verses 1 through 3. Selfish and discontented persons within our ranks have arisen from time to time, telling what great things would be done when their purposes were accomplished, but like a will-o'-wisp, their lights have long since gone out. The cause of present truth, meanwhile, had been surely and steadily making its way round the world, gaining in stability and strength with every advance movement. Elder Stephenson and Hall. During the summer of 1855, Elder Stephenson and Hall endeavored to create a rebellion in the state of Wisconsin. It was well known by the leading brethren that they had desired to try all other points of our faith by their age-to-come doctrine, and were quite anxious that Seventh-day Adventists should be taught the doctrine of probation after Christ's second coming. Prediction concerning them. November 20, 1855, Mrs. White was given a view of their course with a prediction respecting its final outcome in these words, quote, "Think ye, feeble man, that ye can stay the work of God? Feeble man, one touch of his finger can lay thee prostrate. He will suffer thee but a little while." Close quote. Our opponents have said that here was a vision which declared that these men were soon to die. And as they lived for several years, the vision had not been fulfilled. There is nothing in the vision about their dying. They were shown in the capacity of men seeking to stay the work of the third angel's message. While they were informed how easy a thing it would be for God to stop them, it is added, "He will suffer thee but a little while." What did they do? Instead of succeeding in their warfare as they had expected, they seemed to be left to grope their way in darkness. In a few weeks, they entirely gave up the Sabbath, and turned to oppose it. They had hoped to form an age-to-come party with themselves as leaders. Instead of succeeding in this, by giving up the Sabbath, they entirely lost their hold upon our people. Thus, by their own course, they completely defeated what they were first designing to do. Our people said, "Indeed, God has suffered them but a little while." A sad termination of life. As to the outcome of these two men, it may be well to give some statements respecting their sad fate that were made by their own brethren, age-to-come believers, with whom they were associated after leaving the Sabbath. 37 years ago, Mr. Hall became somewhat demented, occasioned by softening of the brain, the cause of this condition being the loss of quite an amount of property by fraud on the part of others. He labored under the delusion that if he should go out of doors, he would flatten out or down to the earth. He is harmless, but of course, for these long years, had been entirely unfitted for ministerial work in any capacity. Footnote number 3. These facts, last noted, were stated by his family to Brother Fredrickson of Dakota in April 1892. Elder Stephenson has been dead about 16 years. For several years before his death, he was of unsound mind, insane, though not dangerous to others. Before becoming thus, under the liberty which he supposed he had with the no-law theory that he had espoused, he left his own wife, a woman against whom no stain of virtue was claimed. He could get a divorce only by employing a dishonest lawyer, and married another woman, much younger than his former wife. This act was such a flagrant violation of morality that his own age-to-come brethren discountenanced his course and would not permit him to preach for them any more. The statements of their own brethren respecting the last days of these men express the deepest pity, yet they are the unvarnished facts which are given without malice or prejudice. With this, we leave our readers to draw their own conclusion with reference to the physical application of the testimony. Elder J. H. Wagner accepts the message. In the year 1852, Elder J. H. Wagner, who had been conducting a county paper in Wisconsin, accepted Present Truth, and in the following year gave himself fully to the work of the ministry. In 1857, he wrote two very important pamphlets of about 200 pages each. The first of these was entitled, quote, "The Nature and Tendency of Modern Spiritualism," close quote, and the second, "A Refutation of the Age to Come." The former has not only been a means of saving many from falling into the snare of Satan, but with God's blessing, it has opened the eyes of many who knew not what to make of these modern manifestations. His refutation of the age to come is a most complete expose of the false theories of probation for sinners after the second coming of our Lord. It is so complete a refutation of that doctrine that it has not only not been answered, but no attempt at a reply has ever yet come under our observation. The book sets forth, in a most clear and concise manner, the position of Christ as a priest on his Father's throne, his Melchizedek priesthood, during the present dispensation, and the position he will occupy on his own throne in his future eternal kingdom, a throne which no mediatorial priesthood will be connected. Still later, Elder Wagner wrote a third pamphlet of about the same size entitled The Atonement in the Light of Reason and Revelation. About the year 1884, this was revised and enlarged to a volume of some 400 pages. It is a clear and concise treatise
upon the subject indicated by its title. From this time, he was closely connected with the publishing work, both as writer and editor. He also continued his ministerial labors, his last years being spent in Europe. April 17, 1889, he suddenly passed away at Basel, Switzerland, just after having completed his last book, From Eden to Eden. On the 16th, he did a full day's work of writing and made this entry in his diary, quote, "Did a hard day's work," close quote. From the report of his case made by European brethren, the following particulars are obtained. Quote, "On the morning of the 17th, at about 5:30, he fell dead in his kitchen without a moment's warning of paralysis of the heart. He had been working very hard to finish up the English edition of his new book, and he expected to start for London on the following Sunday to labor in connection with the work there, previous to returning to America the coming summer." Close quote. From 1854, Elder Wagner had been constantly and prominently before the public in defense of the truth, both in the pulpit and in the press. At the time of his death, he was nearly 69 years of age. He was buried in Basel, April 20, thus fell at his post of duty, another of the early workers in the cause. Faith healing. In the early spring of 1858, Mrs. White had been greatly afflicted for a number of days, being confined to her bed in an almost helpless condition. One evening, near midnight, she fainted. The family tried all the means in their knowledge to restore her to consciousness, but failed in their effort. She remained in this condition for over 30 minutes, when Elder Andrews and myself were hastily summoned by Elder White to join in a season of prayer. In answer to earnest petitions offered at her bedside, the Lord mercifully restored her to consciousness and raised her up to usual health. While offering praises to God, she was taken off in vision, still lying in bed. Some of the things shown her in this view can be read in Testimony for the Church, number 5. Remarkable physical manifestation. A peculiar physical manifestation was connected with this vision, to which we call special attention. Elder White and myself were sitting at one side of the bed, and Elder Andrews at the other side. Her hands were alternately clasped over her breast or moved with her arms in her usual free and graceful manner toward the different scenes she was viewing. The upper portion of her body was raised from the bed so that there was a space of some 8 or 9 inches between her shoulders and the pillow. In other words, the body from the hips upward was flexed at an angle of about 30 degrees. And in that position, she remained during the continuance of the vision, which was about 30 minutes. No one could naturally assume that posture, unsupported by hands and arms, much less hold himself there for that length of time. Here again was proof that some power over which he had no control was connected with the vision. Another prediction. The 1st of October, 1858, a general meeting was held by Elder and Mrs. White and the writer in Rochester, New York. From this meeting, the writer accompanied them on a tour through the state of New York and the New England states. On Sabbath, Mrs. White was given a vision in which she was shown, among other things, that at some place on our contemplated journey, Satan was going to make a powerful attack upon her, and that Elder White and myself must hold on for her by faith, and the Lord would deliver. Mrs. White's affliction. Here again was a prophecy of what would transpire. The sequel will show how accurately it was fulfilled. The first Sabbath after the Rochester meeting, we were at Roosevelt, and the next Sabbath in Brookfield, Madison County. The week following, we held meetings in the commodious kitchen of Mr. Bellew in Mansville, Jefferson County. While journeying by train from Brookfield to Mansville, Mrs. White's face became inflamed just under her eyes. This was so painful that by the time we reached Mansville, she was obliged to take her bed. The inflammation increased for 2 days, depriving her of sleep as well as preventing her from taking any part in the meetings. Her head was swollen so that both eyes were closed, and her face was so disfigured that it no longer looked like that of a human being. Amid all this racking pain and extreme nervousness caused by loss of sleep, the enemy was striving hard to cause her to murmur against God. Thus things continued to the close of the appointed meetings. After the meetings had closed, Elder White said to me, "Brother John, this is the very attack of Satan upon my wife, of which we were warned in Rochester. You remember the promise was there made that if we would take hold together and hold her up by faith, not letting go for a moment when the struggle came, the power of the enemy would be broken and she would be delivered. Let us go in at once and have a praying season." Deliverance as predicted. We went immediately into the room where Mrs. White was confined to her bed and engaged in earnest prayer for her while the brethren in the room where we had been holding meetings remained in silent prayer. In about 10 minutes after we began to pray, the power of the Lord came down and filled the room. Mrs. White was instantly relieved from all pain and at once called for food. This was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. By 7 o'clock, the swelling had all disappeared upon her face, and she attended the meeting that evening, and to all appearance, as well as ever. At the request of the citizens, a discourse was given in the evening on the saints' inheritance, at the close of which Mrs. White gave an exhortation. While Elder White was out of doors with his little boy, W.C., she was taken off in vision before that large assembly. Some of the things shown to her at that time may be read in the closing article of Testimony No. 5, dated Mansville, New York, October 21, 1858. The relief obtained by Mrs. White on the occasion above referred to was as effectual as had been predicted in the view given at Rochester. No difficulty of the kind occurred again on that journey, and we had a glorious victory for the truth at every place. Prediction of the American Civil War. On Sabbath, the 12th of January, 1861, just 3 months to a day before the first gun was fired on Fort Sumter, which was really the opening of the war, which resulted in the liberation of 4 million African slaves in America, the Seventh-day Adventist Meeting House in Parkville, Michigan, was dedicated. The service was attended by Elder White and his wife, Elders Wagner, Smith, and the writer. At the close of the discourse by Elder White, Mrs. White gave a stirring exhortation, after which she took her seat in a chair. In this position, she was taken off into vision. The house was crowded with people, and it was indeed a solemn place. After coming out of the vision, she arose and, looking about the house, said, quote, "There is not a person in this house who has even dreamed of the trouble that is coming upon this land. People are making sport of the secession ordinance of South Carolina, but I have just been shown that a large number of states are going to join that state, and there will be a most terrible war. In this vision, I have seen large armies of both sides gathered on the field of battle. I heard the booming of the cannon and saw the dead and dying on every hand. Then I saw them rushing up, engaged in hand-to-hand fighting, bayoneting one another. Then I saw the field after battle all covered with the dead and dying. Then I was carried to prisons and saw the sufferings of those in want who were wasting away. Then I was taken to the homes of those who had lost husbands, sons, or brothers in the war. I saw their distress and anguish. Close quote. Then looking slowly around the house, she said, quote, "There are those in this house who will lose sons in that war." Close quote. Mrs. Ensign's testimony concerning the visions. As a confirmation of the above fact, and as proof that the prediction was made on the day stated, and as an illustration of how the congregation understood it and circulated it, the following testimony is given. Quote, "This certifies that I was living in St. Joseph County, Michigan, in January 1861, about 6 miles from Parkville. I was not an Adventist. On the 12th day of that month, a number of my neighbors went to Parkville to attend meetings. When they came home, they told me that there was a woman at the meeting that was in a trance, and who said that there was a terrible war coming on the United States, that large armies were going to be raised on both sides, in the South as well as in the North, and there would be many who would suffer in prisons, and pinching want would be felt in many families in consequence of losing husbands, sons, and brothers in the war, and that there were men in the house who would lose sons in that war." Close quote. Signed, Martha V. Ensign, Wildflower, Fresno County, California, January 30, 1891. In connection with the prediction of that fearful war, Mrs. White further stated that Seventh-day Adventists would be brought into strait places in consequence of the war, and that it was the duty of all to earnestly pray that wisdom might be given them to know what to do in the trying times before them. Magnitude of the Civil War. At the time of the giving of the vision, the northern people generally had but little, if any, conception of the pending war. Even President Lincoln, 3 months after April 12, 1861, when several states had joined South Carolina in her secession ordinance and the first gun was fired on Fort Sumter, called for only 75,000 men, and these for the short term of 3 months. The total number of troops enrolled on the Union side during the war was 2,859,132. The Encyclopedia Britannica says that, quote, "The Confederate Army numbered at the beginning of 1863 about 700,000 men," close quote, but that it is difficult to ascertain just how many they had enrolled in all. It estimates their death roll at, quote, "about 300,000 men," close quote. Some of the late encyclopedias place the loss on the Union side of those killed in battle or who died of wounds or diseases contracted in the field or in prisons at 359,528. Of the debt on the Union side, the Britannica says, quote, "The debt reached its maximum August 31st, 1865, amounting to 2 billion $845,907,626.56. Some $800 million of revenue had also been spent mainly on the war. States, cities, counties, and towns had spent their own taxation and accumulated their own debts for war purposes. The payments for pensions will probably amount to $1,500,000,000 in the end. The expense of the Confederacy can never be known. The property destroyed by the federal armies and by Confederate armies can hardly be estimated, and the money value, $2 billion of the slaves in the South, was wiped out by the war. Altogether, while the cost of the war cannot be exactly calculated, $8 billion is a moderate estimate. Close quote. This is taken from Encyclopedia Britannica, the 9th edition, volume 23, page 780. Another confirmation of the vision. As to the prediction concerning the men in the Parkville meeting house losing sons in the war, I will simply state that in the autumn of 1883, I met the elder of the Parkville Church, who was also the elder in January 1861, when the vision was given, and asked him if he remembered the expression made by Mrs. White in relating the vision concerning the war. "Yes," said he, "I do." "Will you tell me how many you know who were in the house that day who lost sons in the war?" He at once recalled the names of five, and said, "I know these were there, and that they lost sons in the war, and if I were at home where I could talk with my people, I could give you more names, I think," he continued. "There were five more besides these that I have mentioned." 4 years and more of persistent fighting on the part of the South, until nearly half of all the mustered forces were lost by death in battle or from sickness, shows a striking fulfillment of the above prediction. Slavery and the War. In relating a vision given her January 4, 1862, Mrs. White said, quote, "Thousands have been induced to enlist with the understanding that this war was to exterminate slavery, but now that they are fixed, they find that they have been deceived, that the object of this war was not to abolish slavery, but to preserve it as it is." Close quote. The foregoing was given at a time when the soldiers were required to aid in the work of returning to their masters all slaves who had escaped into the Union lines, and the soldiers are represented as saying, quote, "If we succeed in quelling this rebellion, what has been gained?" Close quote. They answer discouragingly, "Nothing. That which caused the rebellion is not removed. The system of slavery, which has ruined our nation, is left to live and stir up another rebellion." Close quote. These words, taken from testimony number 7, where a thrilling account of the war is given in full under the head of Slavery in the War, do not state that slavery would never be abolished, but represent the situation as the soldiers then viewed it. A little farther along in the same testimony is a prediction as follows. Prediction of success to the North. Quote, "And yet a national fast is proclaimed, saith the Lord. Is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? When our nation observes the fast which God hath chosen, then will he accept their prayers as far as the war is concerned, but now they enter not into his ear. Close quote. Those who are familiar with the history of the war are aware of the defeats, disasters. Delays, etc., connected with the efforts of the North to conquer the Southern forces up to the time the Emancipation Proclamation was made, January 1, 1863. Then how rapid were the conquests from that time to the close of the war? How evident to those who were watching the progress of the work was the fulfillment of that prediction of January 4, 1862. After the burdens were lifted, the bondage was loosened and the yoke broken from the slave. How evident that God heard the prayers of his people and favored the effort to close the war when they chose the fast pleasing to him. Ex-Governor St. John's testimony. In a speech by ex-Governor John P. St. John of Kansas in Ottawa, Illinois, to which I listened on the afternoon of June 29, 1891, he made the following statement, quote, "I was never so disappointed as I was when the Confederates whipped us at Bull Run. But it was all a part of God's plan. Had we whipped the Confederates, the politicians would have hatched up a peace and the Union would have been continued with slavery, and we would have had it today. For 2 years, the Confederates had the advantage. But after Lincoln issued the famous Emancipation Proclamation, we had swung round to God's side and could not lose." Close quote. This is the end of chapter 21.